Well, I think it's time, so let's get started. Again, welcome. This is the seminar, the workshop, But Homer Was a Pagan. It's an attempt to answer the question, why should a Christian read pagan literature? My thesis, and I'll state this right at the beginning, is that only Christians should read pagan literature because it isn't safe for pagans. And you are dismissed. That's a popularity point there. I do want to say thank you. This will be my last chance to be addressing a relatively large group of you. So I want to begin this session by saying thank you. It is an incredible honor to me to be asked to speak at these conferences. I think maybe now that Lou Gehrig is dead, the luckiest man alive. And I think that I probably have the best job in the world. The opportunity to consult with classical Christian schools that are starting up and full of enthusiasm, or that are working on making adjustments and possibly even discouraged, is a blessing from God that's unimaginable for me even a year or two ago. I have met in this ministry some of the most wonderful people on the face of the earth. And some of you are in this room. And I want to thank you for giving me that opportunity, and I want to thank you for taking the time to come and listen to me speak for 45 or 50 minutes. I really believe that between teaching competent students in high school, homeschool seminars, and ministering to schools in meetings with boards and public gatherings and developing curricula and training teachers, I am truly one of the most blessed men alive. I'm having a good time at this conference too, but I must say I'm losing a lot of weight with all the exercise I'm getting. I have this feeling communists develop the elevators in these buildings. I keep wanting to ride them, but there's these signs on the outside that say, in case of fire, please take the stairs. How often is there a fire in this building? I don't get that. And why did they put the elevators in the building in the first place if you can't use them? Anyway, conferences like these make me sentimental for the old days. Remember when life was so much clearer? The other morning, I awoke very tired. I stumbled into the washroom at my sister's house where I was staying, and I splashed some water on my face. And then I reached over to the hand soap bottle and absentmindedly pumped it into my hand, which I lifted to my face, on which I rubbed the morning soap, only to find that it was a body cream. You know, that's not a big deal, even though it meant smelling like watermelon and cucumber, because the skin does absorb body lotions very nicely. So I moved on, reaching for the toothpaste, which I pumped onto my toothbrush, which I then inserted into my mouth and applied vigorously to my teeth, only to find that it was the hand soap that I had meant to apply to my face earlier. Now, that's not all that big a deal either, given that when I was a child I had plenty of practice with soap in my mouth. So I proceeded to reach for the hair gel, which I pumped onto my hand, which I then lifted to my hair, only to find that it was the toothpaste that I had meant to apply to my teeth a little earlier. Well, that's a bit of a bigger deal. After all, this is, however, thought to be the 21st century, and we don't yet have an established style for the new millennium, so maybe this will be it. At this point, I reached for the body soap, which I pumped into my hand, which I then rubbed on my shoulders and neck, only to find that I was covering my skin with the hair gel that I had meant to apply to my hair earlier. Well, one needs to look on the bright side, and it is true that by now I was awake. Consequently, I no longer needed to take a shower, since I smelled like cucumbers and melon, the whiskers on my face had dissolved, my hair had created a new style, and my neck and shoulders were covered with a rash. I determined on that day that the modern bathroom was not a safe place to be. Don't you long for the days when toothpaste came in tubes, soap came in bars, hand and body cream smelled like sweat, and hair gel was for women? Don't you long for the good old days? Well, if you have a Bible, I'd like you to turn for a moment to Ecclesiastes, to the 7th chapter. I want to read a verse to you from Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 10. By the way, does anybody here have a Strong's Concordance in your back pocket or purse? There's a verse I was looking for and couldn't find. That becomes it. I think it's Jeremiah 6:16. We'll try it and see. It has to do with paths. Anyway, Ecclesiastes 7:10 says, "Do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this." Yes, I'm here to get in trouble. I thought that would be as much of a non-classical verse as I could possibly read. But I'd like you to read next another verse, Jeremiah 21:10, if you have that. Ecclesiastes 7:10 again said, "Do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this." Jeremiah 21:10, on the other hand, says, "For I have set my face against this city for adversity and not for good, says the Lord. It shall be given into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall burn it with fire." I'm sorry, that was the wrong verse. That was my christening verse. Just a moment. It is Jeremiah 6:16. Jeremiah 6:16 says, "Thus says the Lord, stand in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths, where the good way is, and walk in it. Then you will find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk in it." Well, I want to be clear about something, because those two verses seem to be very much in contrast with each other. I want to be clear about what classicism is, and it is not a turn back to the good old days. It is not a turning back to the good old days. Would you mind, in that box is a book called Classical Education. Would you mind bringing that up to me? I meant to put that up here, and I'm stuck here with this wire on me. Let me guess, there aren't any in there. Classical education is not a turning back to the good old days. In fact, as Dr. Veith wrote in his book Classical Education on page 77, classical schools do not denigrate or ignore the past, neither are they nostalgic for it. Acknowledging the continuum of history, classical schools build on the great ideas, discoveries, and expressions of those who have gone before them. They borrow pedagogical forms such as the trivium. Many require or encourage study of Greek and Latin. The great ideas of the past are a starting point, not the last word for the great conversation. David Hicks endorses a poised and balanced understanding when he insists that the true knowledge of Paideia requires a discerning appreciation for the past, unprejudiced by an assumption of progress or regress. And that is what we need, is a discerning appreciation for the past. The good old days involved Christians being thrown to the lions, emperors being killed, one emperor nominating his horse for the Senate, and a number of other very charming things that involved a lot of death and destruction. We may be living, in a certain real sense, in a golden age in human history. We may be. It is the best of times, right? And I suppose it's also the worst of times, as is every age. But in Jeremiah 6:16, he says, ask for the old paths. So why does he say why does God, through the Holy Spirit, instruct us in one passage not to ask for or inquire about the good old days, but in Jeremiah 6:16 he says to ask for the old paths? And I believe the solution is that we are not turning back to the good old days, but we are turning to the permanent. We are turning to the permanent paths that ought never to be overgrown and that need always to be sustained. Now, if you're interested in this, I'm just going to go aside for a moment. This book is written by Ed Veith and myself, and it's called Classical Education Towards the Revival of American Schooling, and is available at my table. My table is, my service is called Circe, and please feel free to stop in on me. The quote that I read by David Hicks is in a book called Norms and Nobility that is also for sale at my table. Two other things I have are a speech that I gave last year at a Houston homeschooling conference called The Paideia of the Lord, The Culture of Education. And the idea there is that paideia, which Paul instructed fathers to raise their children in, is a lot more than just schooling. It's the whole life in which the child is raised. And if you're interested in that, that's also for sale. And then some floppy disks of some history papers that I wrote that describe the origin of classical education from the ancient Greeks up to the time of St. Augustine. Enough on that, but I wanted to mention it to you. We do read old books, don't we? In fact, in classical education, we emphasize old books. And I'd like to tell you briefly my testimony. Some of you maybe have heard this already. My testimony about pagan literature. Because, you know, when you read 1 Corinthians, you get a distinct impression that Paul has a problem with it. In fact, through both books of Corinthians, you get the impression that Paul has a problem with it. When I was about 17 years old, I was regenerated, I believe, as a very young child, probably 3 or 4 years old, if there's a way to put a date on it. And then I grew in a Christian household where my parents taught me the scriptures and all. But around 15 years old, I decided I had to take it seriously. And over the next couple of years, I read the scriptures a great deal, and I prayed, I hope, a reasonable amount. And I sought God. And when I was about 17, I was kneeling by my bed praying, and I looked over to my bookcase. And there on the top shelf, I saw 3 volumes by Steinbeck, 3 volumes by Hemingway, 3 volumes by Vonnegut, and the Iliad and the Odyssey, as I recall. And I looked at those books and I thought, now how can you follow Christ while you're reading those books? And I confess to you that I couldn't resolve that issue. So rather than do a record burning, I guess it is CD burnings now, but rather than do a record burning, I took those books and I disposed of them. I threw them in the garbage because I could not justify reading them. I suspect that some of you have had similar feelings. Why are we emphasizing reading pagan literature? We are Christians. We are devoted to the gospel. And frankly, there are reasons not to read pagan literature. The ones that went through my mind then, and possibly I thought of since then, but there are some. For example, we need that time for the Bible. Every minute you spend reading pagan literature, you could have been reading the Bible. Right? Every hour that you spend on pagan lit, you could have been reading the Bible. Every week, every month in class, all the years you spent in this pagan literature, you could have been reading the Bible. You could have been getting to know God. And instead you read pagan literature. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. There's another reason for it, and I think this comes from a natural, perhaps, insecurity of Christian parents. And that is the anxiety that our children will get involved in the wrong pagan literature or understand pagan literature in the wrong way and be carried away from the faith. I worry about that. I guess I shouldn't, because obviously worry isn't of faith, and whatever is not of faith is sin. But I do worry about it, that my children will get absorbed in the very beautiful elements of pagan lit. I suppose perhaps it's like Pascal's father. Perhaps you know this story. When Pascal was a child, he was homeschooled, and his father gave him enormous amounts of logical training. And by the time he was about 12, he had an incredibly well-trained mind. And his father said to him, Pascal, I don't want you studying geometry. Because if you start studying geometry, you will be so overwhelmed by the beauty of it that you won't want to do anything else. Typical math teacher. Typical math student. Well, one day a guest came to the Pascal mansion, to the Pascal mansion. He would have said Blaze, by the way, sorry, I'm supposed to say Blaze. And a guest came to the mansion, and his father brought the guest up to Pascal's room and said, I want to show you something, because he knew that his son was quite gifted and wanted to just show some of the things that he had learned. Typical homeschool father, right? And he knocked on the door, or didn't, I don't know the details exactly, But they came into the room when suddenly Pascal threw his body on his desk and tried to cover up a number of papers, and of course the father came over immediately suspicious and said, "What are you doing?" And in rather shame-faced way, Blaise removed himself from the papers and had to admit to his father that yes, indeed, he had committed the great iniquity of studying geometry. And for the next 7 years, Pascal, between 12 and 19, became one of the great mathematicians in the history of the world. When he was 19, he had to stop studying geometry because he felt it was absorbing too much of his affection, and he went into the monastery to work with God. Now, sometimes we have to make that choice. There are those who may permanently have to decide they will not read pagan literature. Jerome, who translated the Latin Vulgate, was one. He felt that it was, he loved it so much it had to go. He had to completely cut it out. Pascal eventually had to stop studying geometry. Now, in my case, after a few years, not really a few years, after a little while passed, either I couldn't overcome the temptation, or God relinquished his reins on my soul, and I was allowed to read secular and pagan literature again. And it has come to be over the years a great blessing to me. But I confess to you that if I didn't get rid of them at that time, they probably would have been a serious problem for me. So two reasons. We need that time for the Bible, and it can undercut our faith or our children's faith. A third reason is that the scriptures tell us, after all, not to mention pagan gods, don't they? Let their names not even be mentioned among you. So I believe it was Paul. At least in one place he said it. Of course, Luke, his associate, did mention these pagan gods when he said that Paul was called Zeus or Jupiter, and that Barnabas was called Mercury. So that sort of presents a contradiction we need to resolve. But you can't lose attention. You must never let yourself lose attention between pagan and Christian literature. Because if you do lose attention, you probably have given one or the other too much dominance, too much exclusionary authority. Now, be careful how you take that. I don't mean in any way to imply that pagan literature is of equal authority to the scriptures. But I'm not going to resolve the difference or the tension that I just created for you, because you have to do that yourself. Now, what am I talking about when I talk about pagan literature? Well, basically, I'm talking about literature that was written by pagans. Any literature that was written by non-Christians, but especially the Greeks and Romans before the time of Christ. Because, as C.S. Lewis has pointed out, after being a Christian, you can't go back to being a pre-Christian any more than after being married, you can go back to being a virgin. It isn't an option, and our culture cannot escape the Christian influence that it has had. 1,000 years from now, if it continues to assault us, it will still have a profound Christian influence. In fact, I would suggest to you that the nihilism of postmodernism is only possible as a reaction to Christianity. If it weren't for Christianity, to which the modern mind is reacting, it would probably still be able to function in a more or less rational way. But I'm talking about pagans who primarily lived before Christ, but I will include any pagans that ever wrote. But I'm going to include not only literature, but also classical philosophy in my argument somewhat, you'll see. Now, here's what I want to do. I said that only Christians should read pagan literature because it's not safe for pagans. And I will defend that only the first part in this talk, because I want to talk about the benefit of pagan literature to a Christian. Some of these will be more serious than others. Some of them will be, I trust, more profound than others. And some of them may come across to you as flippant. That's okay with me, because I believe the goal of education is to get every joke, and so if you think some of these things are flippant, well, then you get it. Well, actually, there is a secondary goal to education, and that is to understand Shakespeare. And now for the serious side of the flippant comment, you do need, and by the way, these are in no priority of order, I'm just throwing them out at you. You do need to have some knowledge of pagan literature to understand Shakespeare. And the reason for that is because Shakespeare made incredibly heavy use of pagan literature, especially Ovid, but he also understood classical rhetoric in a way that we're trying to recapture. I don't know if he knew he did, but the way they taught in those days was very much the development of classical rhetoric. So if we're going to understand Shakespeare, we need to understand classical literature, pagan literature. Also, Spencer, Edmund Spencer, if you want to understand him. And then maybe one that might be more explicitly obvious, you need to understand John Milton, a good old-fashioned Christian writer, right? Well, John Milton wrote what some have called a Christian pagan poem in Paradise Lost, because it is so full of pagan themes and pagan developments and so on. So the first reason is to understand other literature, to understand literature since the pagan. Shakespeare, Spencer, Milton, C.S. Eliot, C.S. Lewis, and on and on and on. The second reason, a little more pleasant perhaps, is that I believe that pagan literature provides for us an ornament for life. It is a gift of God to His church if they can properly discern it. It's an ornament. There are great beauties in pagan literature, as there are great beauties in the ground when you find diamonds. And we can find in pagan literature something of a refined diamond sometimes. So it's a great ornament for life. An extraordinarily practical point. With pagan literature, you have great illustrations. Whether you're writing or speaking, you can illustrate point after point after point. Let me see if I can illustrate that. I should have prepared that part ahead of time. Can anybody here think of an example in pagan literature where a pagan illustrates something from literature? Aristotle does it, yeah. Aristotle in his work on poetics uses Sophocles, Oedipus Rex is the perfect poem. There, I've done it. You can illustrate your point through pagan literature. Pagan literature, by the way, if I can just develop that, is very human. It's been called humanistic. And humanistic doesn't only mean secular human, humanistic. Humanistic is the idea of pursuing human excellence. And so there is a Christian humanism. In fact, I think Christianity is the only humanism that works. But human excellence, when you are in the pursuit of human excellence, you are being humanistic. That's the original sense of the word. And the Greeks were obsessed with the notion of human excellence. And so in Greek and Roman literature, you see a great deal of reflection on what is human greatness. And that's a great discussion, by the way, to be involved in. And leads to my next point, which is psychological growth. I think that pagan literature gives us enough insight into ourselves that we can grow in our understanding of human psychology. Now, that can be perverted badly in, for example, Jungian psychotherapy or Freudian psychiatry that builds on the Oedipal complex and all that sort of thing. And a lot of their notions, it's so ironic because they're trying to be modern, and where do they go to be modern? But back to the pagans, to the pre-Christian pagans. Those are perversions of what I'm talking about, but they had great insight into human nature. We can talk later, perhaps, why that is, but we can grow psychologically in our self-understanding through pagan literature. I also believe that pagan literature gives us a cure for modern Eastern-oriented psychological theories. Now, that relates to Jung again, but most modern psychology, I shouldn't say most, but there's an extreme dose of Oriental mysticism mingled into modern psychology. Paul Vitz, in his book Psychology as Religion, describes some of that. If you like to read somebody a little more on the edge, I guess, read Dave Hunt, who wrote a book called The Seduction of Christianity. And when you get into the parts on prophecy, you might want to reconsider some of his conclusions. But when he's describing psychological movements, especially as how they're impacting the church, got some important insights, because the church has embraced too much paganism by not realizing it was paganism, but by thinking it was sort of nice sounding. Norman Vincent Peale and Robert Schuller are the classics of a sort of a human potential movement Christianity. Robert Schuller made a deliberate decision in the 60s, having done market research, that sin was no longer popular, and so he would talk about positive self-esteem and wonderful things like that. Well, that leads straight to a Napoleon Hill sort of Eastern mysticism. Our greatness comes from voices within and other transcendental ideas. Please beware of that. Paganism, frankly, can put that into such clear and explicit terms that it becomes less of a threat. You understand what's going on a little bit better. Now, here's a really important point. One of the best benefits of pagan literature is that it aids us in our reasoning. It aids us in our reasoning. Now, I want to ask you a question. What is human reason? What is human reason? Let me follow that up. Is there such a thing as human reason? Is reason a human thing? One of the things that I've had to deal with and think about very hard because of my presuppositions as a believer was this whole issue of what is the role of reason in the Christian life? And what are the limitations of reason? And I read a lot of Bible commentaries and theological works, and they would frequently refer to the concept of human reason. And it's always puzzled me, what is this human reason? Did we sort of invent that out of the air? Did we create a way of reasoning? Do you realize that in a certain sense, when you talk about human reason, you've given the argument over to the modernist? That's or at least the postmodernist, that's the modern argument. Reason is something that we create. It's not really a being world, but it's the world of the mind, the world of, we create the world we live in. That idealistic pantheon, absence of reality from the thing out there. Well, reason isn't human. Reason, forgive me for this if it offends you, but reason is divine. Reason is divine. Human reasoning happens. But no human will ever be able to create reason. And therefore, if our reason is perfectly pure, if our use of reason is perfectly pure, we will come to the knowledge of truth. The obstacle we have is sin. And that's ethical, and it sure affects our thinking. We don't find truth because we don't reason well, and we don't reason well because we don't want to reason well. I think perhaps an illustration of this would be the fact that we now frequently get involved in debates trying to prove the existence of God as apologists. And that cannot be done. You can't prove that there's a God, nor can you prove that there isn't a God. You simply know that there's a God. Now here's the danger of that. If we try to prove that there's a God, then the atheist, who doesn't exist, will try to prove that there isn't a God by disproving our argument that there is a God. You see what's happened? We just shifted to their ground. By trying to prove that there is a God, we subject God to reason. And if the atheist can disprove our argument, he can believe that he has proved that there is no God. And starting about 250 years ago, they started doing that aggressively, and Immanuel Kant, who understood the issue a lot better, who did believe in a God, but proved that you can't prove that there's a God, tried to clear the air, and instead, the Christian continued to try to prove that there's a God, and the atheist just continued to prove that there isn't a God by disproving the Christian's argument that there is a God. Isn't that fun? Reason is based on the premise that there's a God. Now, I base that statement, which is crazy and radical and dogmatic, on Exodus 3:14, in which Moses sees God in the burning bush. Moses, who had grown up on pagan literature, was the wisest and most learned man on the face of the planet, because he was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, which was substantial. Also had learned the Hebrew teaching from his mother, and no doubt from his father-in-law, had learned about the one true God. He probably knew more about religion than any man on the face of the planet, but I believe that when God appeared to him, He wasn't sure who he was. And the reason I say that is because when God said, "Tell Pharaoh to let my people go," Moses' response was, "Who are you?" Now, when Moses asked that question, it implies to me, and I believe this to be the case, that Moses was wondering whether the Egyptians were right or whether his mother was right. Now, here's the difference between ancient mythology and ancient Hebrew thought. Ancient mythology is like modern New Age thought. There was no real world. The physical world was an illusion. Being is something you need to escape. Being itself is an illusion. You need to transcend being and non-being. Sort of the Tao of Pu, if you've seen that book in an airport. Buddhist thought and Hindu thought are based largely on the notion of the illusory nature of being. So was ancient Egyptian thought. And the foundation of all thought, the foundation of all theology, the foundation of all reasoning is a very simple statement by God to Moses. Because what did God say to Moses when he said, "Who should I say has sent me?" "I am. I am." Now, if God is, then being is. And Hamlet's question is answered. To be or not to be, God gives us the answer. He is, and because He is, so are we. Now, that sounds laughable to us, perhaps. I hope it does. I hope that sounds laughable. To Moses, it wasn't. It was the foundation of all revelation and meaning. And it's also the foundation of Aristotelian logic. Isn't that interesting? Why did the Greeks get such great insights? Well, I believe it's because of, I believe when God said to Abraham, "In your seed all the nations of the earth will be blessed," Greek philosophy is one instance of that. Because there's evidence that Pythagoras studied under Ezekiel, and there is clear evidence, or clearer at least evidence, that Plato himself went and studied in Alexandria, which was populated by a large Jewish population at that time. And therefore, when the Greeks came in contact with the Jews, they learned about the concept of being. And they were so excited by it that they took it back to Greece and laid the foundations of philosophy. Now the trouble, of course, is that they didn't have or accept revelation, and so they made every manner of mistake, but they did accept the wonderful concept of being, which led to Platonic dialogues, but even more explicitly, it led to Aristotle's philosophy. And that's why, as Christians, we cannot reject Aristotelian philosophy, sorry, Aristotelian logic, without rejecting our own theology.
Fire. But he makes clear the implications of being. We have creeds and confessions because of the Greek influence on Christian thought. That Greek influence on Christian thought was part of the providence of God and was used rightly in most of the creeds and confessions. And so we are not free in a universe that God made and in a universe that does truly exist to reject pagan thought in its entirety. Because if we do, we will be rejecting elements of Christian thought. That probably was a difficult point. I hope that there's some degree of clarity. The application at the end is important, that we cannot reject pagan or non-Christian thought in its entirety, because if we do, we reject Christian thought. It throws us into the confusion of the modern church when we do that. Another reason, we can't know our history without pagan thought, and I mean pagan literature, and I think it's important to know our history. We are if I dare put it this way, a combination of pagan Greek, pagan Roman, Anglo-Saxon, French, German, Western European, and a lot of other cultures thrown together into this mutt-mix we call Americanism. If we're going to understand ourselves, we need to understand our history, and our history is rooted in Hebrew and Greek thought. I'm teaching a seminar to high school students this fall and through the spring called The Roots of American Order. I confess I stole the name from Russell Kirk, and I'm following the same pattern. I tell the parents, I'm teaching American history beginning with the ancient Hebrews, because that's where it starts. If you want to understand our Constitution, you need to know Magna Carta, and it's important. And you need to know King Alfred, and you need to know English common law, and you need to know the Anglo-Saxon traditions that Thomas Jefferson felt were the foundation of all just law, and so on. So if we're going to know our history, we need to know pagan literature. Another reason is aesthetic taste. Again, I think this is very important. The Christian community, let's say 30 years ago, the Christian community rejected pop culture, let's say 40 years ago, before Larry Norman, the Christian community rejected pop cultural expressions without critical evaluation. 40 years ago, the Christian community rejected pop cultural expressions without critical evaluation. They were so accustomed to their own order and way of doing things that when pop culture came along, they panicked and said Elvis is from the devil. Now, we embrace pop cultural expressions in the church without critical evaluation. And that troubles me deeply. You cannot say in the modern church, or to a modern teenager, or especially youth pastor, you cannot say that music isn't appropriate in the church, because there is no means to discuss that issue. Music is entirely a matter of taste, and if you don't like it, it's because you are old-fashioned or a fuddy-duddy or one of those classical kind of things. Well, if you're going to come to understand aesthetic taste, you're going to need to learn to read aesthetic theory, criticism, which began with Aristotle. Aristotle laid down foundations for criticism, I love this, in the concept of being that served as the foundations of aesthetics. That is why, for nearly 2,000 years, the church adopted, with slight adaptations, Aristotelian aesthetics. 40 years ago, we decided we would go for Jean-Jacques Rousseau and South African tribalism instead, neither of which would be rejected without critical evaluation. But you see how important it is that you have concepts by which to evaluate. The modern youth culture has taken over the church to a very depressing extent. I was in church on Sunday, and I was visiting, so I don't have to say where I was or anything. You can't track it down. But it was a church that had leadership that I respect very much, full of godly men, wonderful ministry. And they brought their Sunday school up on stage, and the first grade class was led by, I would guess, a 17-year-old youngster who led them in a rap. Now, I'm not going to say whether or not rap is right or wrong, but I will tell you that it was done with expressions of arrogance, the movements of rap are arrogant movements. It was done arrogantly. And I'm not saying the young man was arrogant, but he was expressing arrogance, and he was expressing an in-your-face tone, which rap is built on. And if we don't understand the foundational impulses that are being expressed in music and art, then we will be overrun by the aesthetic culture. Now, another thing I want to go into is that I don't believe the church has lost its influence in our culture because we don't have a better argument. Now, as I said before, we have made the mistake of trying to prove that there is a God instead of laying out the moral law before people and showing them their guilt. But apart from that, we have pretty decent arguments in our seminaries and so on. That isn't why we've lost to our culture. We've lost to our culture because we are aesthetically inept. And I can't tell you how much I've appreciated Mr. Wilson's input this week or his comments about how if we're going to communicate, and I guess I'm drawing implications from what he said, but if we're going to communicate with our culture, we can't be so pathetic about it. I always worry that I'm going to offend somebody with a statement like this, but I get antsy when I see the bumper sticker wars going on. Now, let me clarify. If they're in good humor, I think they can be very funny sometimes. You know, the fish being eaten by Darwin, which is then being eaten by Truth, eating Darwin. That's kind of cute. I have a hard time believing many cars are pulled off to the side of the road and people fall on their knees in repentance the way they would when Jonathan Edwards would preach, though, when they see these magnets and bumper stickers. Now, my concern is that we need, if we are communicating the gospel, we need to do it in an appropriate way. Because the fundamental principle of any aesthetic theory, but Christian aesthetics especially, is the idea of propriety. Propriety. If the way we are communicating is inappropriate, it doesn't matter what we are communicating. Now, of course, the defense is, yeah, but I knocked that guy off his bike and then gave him a track and he got saved. Well, just because God does miracles doesn't mean we should disobey him. Okay? God saved me too. And this was a miracle. But it doesn't mean my parents should go out of their way to bring me up wrong so I'll grow up bad and feel bad about how bad I am and come to repentance. It just doesn't work that way. We need to learn the appropriate expressions for the gospel. And then we need to give the gospel its apt expression. The Bible, I don't know if you've noticed this, the modern translations to an extent try to minimize it in some cases, but the Bible is a rather formally written book. The Psalms in particular follow, by the way, this is another reason for reading pagan literature. The Psalms are written on the pattern of the pagan cultures surrounding Israel. They didn't invent a heavenly art form. They followed the rhythms and schemes and tropes and all that sort of thing of the pagan cultures around them. That does not mean that we should, without criticism, do the same. It does mean that we should not, without criticism, reject the cultural forms around us. As Mr. Wilson said a couple years back, it is a deep, dark, hidden secret of the Reformation movement that everybody's favorite movie is In Search of the Holy Grail. He said that, not me. We need to learn to engage our culture aesthetically. We need to make beauty beautiful. We need to make truth beautiful. And we need to make goodness beautiful. Because if we don't, we aren't being true to truth and goodness. Because truth is beautiful. And goodness is beautiful. Consequently, based on the presupposition of being, if we communicate truth in an ugly way, we lie. And if we communicate goodness in an ugly way, we lie in the way we do it. It is imperative that we learn aesthetic taste. Aesthetic taste can only be developed through interaction with cultural expression. Well, I could go on about the influence of pagan literature on Western culture, and so I will. Predominantly, that's Homer, and I have to talk about Homer because Homer is the greatest writer in the world except for Shakespeare. Can I make a comment about that? Because that was really an interesting thing I just said. Homer was the perfect Greek writer, and Shakespeare was the perfect English writer. And the reason I say that is because Homer used the Greek language to its perfection. Greek is different from English, however. If you have the same degree of form and schemes and structure in English that you have in Greek, you will strain the reader beyond measure, as illustrated in Dryden's translation of the Aeneid and other
heroic couplet sagas that go on and on and on and on, and they're very musical and they're very lovely, but by the 48th page, you need a break. In Greek, it's different. In English, we are Greek and German and French and Latin and even a little bit of Russian. We have some American Indian. We have all these different languages coming together, and therefore you've got to have the greatest poetry in English would be pushing the limits of the language. And that's what Shakespeare did. He invented English. He used English like nobody ever has, and I don't think ever will again. Until there's a, you know, a dark age, and then we come out of it, some great writer will bring all these new forces together. But Shakespeare was magnificent. And I already told you that you need to read Shakespeare. But Homer's influence on Western culture is even more enormous than Shakespeare's influence on American or English culture. And the first reason I say that is because I believe, as some modern scholars are beginning to argue, that it is to Homer that we owe the invention of the alphabet. What do you mean, you say? We had the alphabet before Homer. Well, not exactly. We didn't have the complete alphabet with vowels and that sort of thing until around the time of Homer. And Archaeological Odyssey had a wonderful inaugural issue with an essay all about this if you want to go into it some more. But the whole argument is that the complete alphabet that we use now was created specifically so that Homer could be put into written form. And that was God's providential way of preparing Western culture for the Bible. I think the alphabet matters a little bit. Western literature almost follows the footnote to Homer. And his poetry and his insights and his values will lead you, maybe not the first time, maybe not the second time, but will lead you eventually into insight about human life and character and the ancient world and the modern world and the permanent world that you can't get anywhere else. And so I would suggest to you that Homer has had an influence on Western culture that you need to be in touch with. Okay, so another benefit from reading pagan literature is that in doing so you read what are called classics. They're called classics. Now, we talk about classical culture, and if I may suggest a definition for classical culture that I got from H.I. Maru, it is that a classical culture is a culture based on a text, on an authoritative text. Now, ancient Greek culture was based on Homer. Roman culture was based on Homer and the three tragedians and the comedians and maybe Virgil and a couple others. Those were the textual foundations of culture, because in the text was a higher vision of life to which everybody should aspire. That is not Christianity, but it certainly parallels it, doesn't it? Christianity is a culture based on a text. And that text presents us with a higher vision of life to which we want to aspire. The classical culture prepared the way for the Christian culture to be that higher vision of life. It wasn't sufficient. But it was, as the medievalist said, the preparatorio fide, the preparation for the faith. I mentioned creeds already, and the last point I'll make is that by reading pagan literature, we have an inoculation or possibly even a cure for the modern disintegration. No, I am going to make one more point. I'm only 1 minute over time, so I'm going to take a little more time. We have a cure for the modern disintegration of the mind because the pagan mind, being pre-Christian, was not deliberately disintegrated like ours is. I'll leave that at that, and now I want to make my last point, which will surprise all of you pleasantly. By reading pagan literature, we learn how to understand and study the Bible. Well, how can this be, we say? Well, practically speaking, it's very difficult to teach Bible study methods by using the Bible. And the reason is because when you approach the Bible, you've already got a lot of conclusions. It's very difficult for you to approach it, shall we say, with an open mind or abstractly, or however you want to put it. So Gutenberg College out in Oregon did something I consider brilliant. They decided they would teach Bible study methods by studying great pagan literature. And the reason for it is because you can do it without beginning having already taken a stand on the text. And so you can engage in an analysis of the text, you can argue the text, You can even draw swords over the text. But at least your eternal soul isn't being argued about. And so there's a certain degree of innocence, and if I can put it this way, irrelevance. A pleasant irrelevance to the text in that sense that isn't there when you study the Bible. When you study the Bible, there is always such a moral weight to it. There is almost some inner compulsion, some inner need to revert back to what you were brought up on. And so by going to the pagan text, you can learn how to study with an objective mind. And I think that's an important thing. But one other point I would make is about the content. We can understand the content of the Bible by a judicious study of pagan literature. For example, I mentioned earlier Paul and Silas being accused of being Zeus and Hermes. Well, when I was in high school, I read the story many times, Sunday school, whatever, and I thought, oh, that's kind of neat. I wonder who Zeus and Hermes were. And then I learned who Zeus and Hermes were, and suddenly that story became quite humorous, frankly, and a lot more interesting. I could understand the Bible in that passage in a deeper way because I knew pagan literature and pagan content. Another example is the gods of Egypt. When we read about the 10 plagues, the Bible doesn't bother describing a whole lot about the gods of Egypt. But you can get these neat little chart books that describe how the Egyptian gods were all confronted by the God of Israel in the 10 plagues and were slaughtered, frankly. And the Israelites started writing psalms like Our God Reigns and good stuff like that. One last point I'm going to make, and I'll make it briefly because somebody just gave it to me today. By learning pagan literature, we have a platform on which we can speak the truth. It's a bridge. It's something we share with the pagan. We're both interested in human issues. Our difference with the pagan is not in our questions. Our difference with the pagan is in our answers. And so we can explore the same questions and be aware of how they ask them, and have more insight into their questions than they do by reading their literature and interpreting in the light of our literature. Please be aware of the limitations. Be aware of the dangers. Pagan literature is not inspired by the Holy Spirit. It cannot take the place of or minimize the Scriptures. And precisely because of its beauty, it can distract from our highest priorities. But if your soul is in order, pagan literature is a gift from your husband, Christ, to you and Christ, as an ornament, as a practical application, and as a source of wisdom. Let's give thanks to him, shall we? Our Father in heaven, we are astounded by your gracious provision and generous grace to us. And we pray that you would let us never, ever forget the giver of every perfect gift. And in so doing, help us to be thankful, never covetous, never bitter, but always grateful and thankful to you, who are worthy of so much more than our gratitude. Amen.
Thank you.